when it probably would have been. If they built me up and then I start losing, then you get dashed to the side. But because I'd got there, and earned my place there, then when I had my opportunity, I really earned my place. So that's when the phone started ringing from you know, my promoter and my TV broadcaster. No, we actually want Sonny to fight now. We've seen he can fight, but I'd earned it. I didn't mind being hidden away. I've been through, you know, when people used to slag each other from BBM and you know, like actual personal things. And I've been through actual, like, harder stuff on it. Now, all these people don't know who I am. They don't know what I do in my day to day. They know what I show them. So if they want to have a go and pick a part of my life, they don't know me. I'm happy with me. I'm happy with myself. I feel like I'm doing right by my kids. I'm doing right by my friends. I'm doing right in boxing. They wanted to start treating her within a time frame. She was in a queue or she was in something. She should have got an MRI scan. The MRI scan never happened because they wanted to start the treatment. And they didn't find, because they didn't look, a brain tumour. And the treatment caused a leak on the brain, pressure, fluid. And a few operations later, a few major brain surgeries. Do you know what I mean? She's brain damaged in the state she is now.
Hello, and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tristix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
Just, you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's beating me. He said, well, let's pull him back.
In the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
His winning and his nothing else.
Hello, welcome back to Boxing Life Stories. I'm Tris Dixon. Thank you so much for the kind words about last week's episode with the fantastic Sheffield trainer, Glyn Rhodes. It was a humbling interview and I really hope you enjoyed it. Some of you were deeply moved and affected by it and I understand that. And I just wanted to thank Glyn again for his time and for sharing what he did share last week. If you haven't checked it out, please go back and give it a listen. This week, Sonny Edwards, the reigning IBF flyweight champion, joins me. I visited Sonny at his gym in Sheffield, where I've gone to see him before, actually. I've done a piece with him for BT Sports, No Filter Boxing, which you can probably check out on YouTube. Talking of YouTube, you can also see this interview with Sonny up on my YouTube channel. Search Boxing Life Stories, Tris Dixon, Sonny Edwards on YouTube, and you'll find it. Sonny's one of the most outspoken characters in the sport today, and he recently won his world title in just his 16th professional fight. He's got a hugely provocative social media presence, but he's backing it all up in the ring and was brilliant winning the title against South Africa's Maruti Mathlalane, who's a living legend, really. Before I leave you with Sonny, I do want to thank my sponsors. Hanson Lee Resourcing were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they'll help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, who are a leading provider of professional fire, asbestos and safety services to businesses nationwide. They offer one expert point of contact for all of your fire, health and safety compliance needs, and you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. And now here's Sonny Edwards. Sonny, IBF world champ. How does it feel? Does it feel any different?
It feels good, but mainly I feel like I've just got a big target on my back now. I mean, already the IBF mentioning mandatories, already I've got opponents that I've tried chasing down for years to fight me, now calling me out. So that's the only real difference, to be honest. But as people keep saying it's going to sink in, but I've always thought I was destined for a lot more than just one world title. I know that sounds... No, I know it's a great achievement and I'm so proud and happy to be where I'm at. But if you ask me at the beginning of my pro career, would you be happy with just one more title, that's the in and out, then the answer would definitely have been no.
Is it refreshing to have the target on your back though? Because when I came here and interviewed you, I don't know, I guess it was about a year and a half ago, maybe even 2 years ago, you couldn't get the fights you wanted.
Yeah, I know. And it's been frustrating at periods of times because there's certain fights that I've had, the great learning fights, hard fights as well, good opponents in their own right. But do you know when you're fighting opponents that it's sort of the name versus the opponent? It's hard for the general public, the boxing fans, to really get behind them sort of fights, for them to really mean anything, for the wins to really mean anything and get the credit. People have to be excited about both fighters. And obviously, I think Maruti really did that. And now, Like I've got one of the biggest stocks and platforms in the world of flyweight boxing, you know what I mean? So
what's the dream for you, the dream next move? Obviously, you've got obligations and people are talking about different things, but what would you like?
Well, I seen Frank put out that I've got a mandatory against Filipino Jason Mama. I think he's dealt with by the same people as Manny Pacquiao. I'm not 100% sure. Pardon me, sorry. He was actually meant to fight Moretti before I did, and that's the fight that was meant to happen in December of 2020. And then due to something that happened with the organiser of the show, the fight got pulled last minute, so it never happened. And then that's why I don't think he minded. You know, he got paid some step-aside money, and he didn't mind someone else having a go at Moretti, because obviously that fight never happened because of of reasons not fully aware to me, but something to do with just the amount of support and backing that Moretti is getting, I believe, within South Africa. So now I'm the champion. It's going to be easier to get Mamma to fight. So I think he was happy with that.
How did it feel getting your hand raised, winning the world title?
When the final bell.
You didn't seem as happy as Grant was.
I'm quite cool, calm and collected. My dad always used to teach me that, you know, when you win a fight and then start doing tuck jumps, jumping up and down, screaming, it's almost as if you're surprised that you've won. And I'm never surprised that I've won. I expect it of myself. The surprise is if I ever and when I lose, do you know what I mean? That's the surprise to me. But I had my little bit of excitement. You see me sort of banging my hand on my head just before, as the results was getting read out. That was probably me sort of releasing all my excitement in a sensible manner. Yeah, 100%. As soon as the final bell went, I was in no. I thought there's no chance. I knew I won 7 rounds clearly, the first 7 in my eyes. I knew I was 7 rounds up, so I just knew if I didn't get put down, if he didn't knock me out, then I would have won the fight.
Was it getting hard in there with the pressure he was applying? Because he was picking up from round 7 onwards.
Definitely. He really, 9th round, he really started investing and sort of just going. And don't get me wrong, my legs were starting to feel the pace. Nothing, like no panic stations. It weren't like any point I was spent, but sometimes you need to just remind yourself and sort of take that deep breath around, let's get going, do you know what I mean? And I had Grant in the corner as well, reminding me of times when I was slowing down a bit, what I needed to do. But I always felt, for the most part, in control, I'll be real. Don't get me wrong, I knew it was hard, but there wasn't a second in that 36 minutes that I didn't think that final bell was coming.
You've crossed words with your opponents in the past, but you got on well with Moretti, didn't you?
Yeah, well, I knew him personally. When we was out in Ukraine, we never sparred, but we spent 2.5-3 weeks eating breakfast, lunch and dinner on the same table, going to round Kiev, doing the tourist things, looking at the football stadium, looking at the...
What was this for?
We was paid sparring partners for Artem Dalekayan, who's the WBA world champ.
Okay.
I think the first camp, it was just before his Brian Villoura fight, so before he was actually the world champ, in his challenge. And then the second time I went over there, it was when he was defending.
Right, okay. Had you sparred Moretti at all?
No, we never sparred. We was doing each other's like corners for some of the rounds and like little bits of advice and whatnot. But with me, I'm a big sparrer. I always spar. I've sparred 10, 12 rounds since I was a kid. I was down Newham Gym the other day in one of my old gyms when I was like 11 and 12. And one of the people that was there was saying how he remembers me doing 12 rounds, like literally they wouldn't let me out because I was sparring everyone, do you know what I mean? But that's always what I was used to, that's what I was used to.
Was this right back in the day Moretti told you were going to be a world champ?
Yeah, so after the first time he watched me spar, it was my second spar, he got there a day after us or something. I went up, asked for a picture after that, just as soon as I jumped out. I think he might have either finished the spar or he might have been before me, I can't remember. Asked for a picture and then he went, oh, I really like your style, you'll 100% be a world champion. And it just happened that...
It was against him.
Yeah, which, a bit like the stars aligning, but he was right, I suppose.
Did it take anything away from the moment not having fans there?
Not really. Obviously, I would have loved to have done it in front of a packed crowd and everyone be excited and sort of feel the... Because I could feel it just with the like 30 people that was in the hall between... You know, Uncle Frank, the few people I could have supporting me, my manager, my trainers, you know what I mean? The the media people, I could sort of feel them all coming in the fight with me. Do you know what I mean? And you could hear them all shouting. And when I was landing, I was getting behind every shot, reminding me when I weren't as switched on as I needed to be. They were sort of bringing me back. So it did feel, even though it was like a bit intimate, I had my people there, and it just probably would have been multiplied. Yeah. So I, at the same time, I still feel like I did to a certain degree, because a lot of obviously the right people was there, people that have been with me since day dot, you know. So it was good.
Did it take anything away from it not having your pigtails in?
Do you know what? Yeah, there was, when the fight first got announced and I was having this kit, it was like my version of the Joker. I played with the idea of having green pigtails. I was going to dye my hair green and have pigtails. And I decided against it because I thought, I cannot do that and get ironed out in front of everyone. So I just cannot do it.
You would have had to have the Joker lipstick as well.
I know. Do you know what? I had the mask for the ring walk, but yeah.
What was the Joker thing? What was that? What was that born from?
So all my kits usually have a theme. I like sort of starting with a theme, then making the kit. Do you know what I mean? Me and Susie Wong this time, Yield Gallery, my sponsor, they was involved. Because this kit was really more like a piece of art. So I always knew that I wanted to do a Joker theme at some point. You know, other themes I've done Frank Lucas, American Gangster, I've done Thanos, Avengers, I've done a Matrix theme, I've done Goku out of Dragon Ball Z. Like, I like my themes, you know what I mean? Venom, one of my favourite ones. So yeah, Joker was always one, but I wanted it to be for a big one because I had a good idea. But I wanted to put me in it. So once I'd sort of teamed up and was collaborating with Yield Gallery, they got an artist in by Nathan Bowen, who's a quite well-known in London street artist, contemporary artist. So we sort of just put it together. You had my dog there, the one you just met. He's in it. You've got a belt over my shoulder, walking across London Bridge, out of London. Do you know what I mean? So there was just a few like personal touches. It even had green pigtails in it. So I just wanted to do a Joker, but my version. I mean, I like putting my imprint on anything I do. So, yeah, obviously I was lucky to have a proper artist that was going back and forth from designs, so we could really make it how we wanted it.
Some people wrote you off before Maruti, saying it was too big a jump up in class. Maruti hadn't lost since, I think, 2008, if I remember rightly. A long time anyway. And, you know, it was just too soon for you. Was that fuel to the fire? Was that motivation?
I've always sort of been told one way or another that the next level is where I'm going to be found out. It's always been that way for me, since amateurs, since England, since GB, since I've turned pro. A lot of people on GB that were like friends with me or the coaches that have been coaching me were half laughing at me turning pro when I did. I had a very sort of negative flit around the ring style, similar to what I do now, but probably I'm a lot more positive with it now. But yeah, I was always told that he's probably not going to do nothing. I mean, it's always going to be, it might work in the ABAs against the English kids, but when you go internationally, that's when it's not. Then it did, and then I turned pro. Okay, it might work against a journeyman, but it's not going to work when he's in 10, 12 round half fights. He's not going to be able to do that style over them rounds. And then I did. And then it was always, okay, but when he gets to world level, he's going to get knocked out. Braithwaite put him down, Granados put him down. And then I boxed the number one in the division and I think I showed what I've been saying. I've always said, yeah, okay, that might, like, I can pick a couple of performances. They probably weren't my best nights. They probably weren't shining me in the best light. Usually there's reasons as to why and why not. But when I need to turn it up, I turn it up.
When you say reasons, do you mean like injuries or stuff going on away from the ring and your mind's not on the job or what?
Yeah, injuries a lot of the time. Because anything that sort of, I don't mind sort of living quite, I don't want to say chaotic, but I don't mind there being sort of other spinning things, because that usually helps me just focusing on what I need to do while sort of dealing with everything else. I mean, I had a kid come out what, 3 or 4 weeks before this fight. I've done that before against Junior Granados, 10 days before my first son was born, 10 days before a fight. I dropped his mum to the hospital. Left, came straight to this gym now, sparred 10 rounds with Louis Norman, looked at my phone, oh, we're not ready yet. Went and picked her up in 6 o'clock in the morning, was back there, and the baby was born at 10:30. And then I left, went and trained, you know what I mean? So when they're spinning things on, I don't really mind that all too much. But injuries, I've I've never pulled out of a fight and I've had injuries multiple times and niggles that most fighters would have pulled out of. Most fighters. When I boxed Braithwaite, both my hands were gone. My knuckles were smashed to pieces. I posted a little video after the fight. But by the second round, both my hands, I couldn't throw a right or a left without my hands hurting. And I had to do 12 rounds. Do you know what I mean?
But how big a jump up was Maruti?
A lot of people look down at Asomba and how good he is because of his record and the times that he's been in journeyman mode. There was a time that it was taking short notice fights. But any time he's really been beat, it's been always fine margins by good kids. You know, Jay Harris, Lee McGregor, Carl Williams. And these fights he was taking on shorter notice. With me, he had a long camp. I had a long camp, so I know he had about 14 weeks, same as me, or whatever it was. We had a long period of time knowing about this fight. And then, look, 6 weeks after my fight, he went up, what, two or three weights and got a draw with Thomas Patrick Ward, 29-0 super bantamweight. So the version I got was the one that beat McGoldrick, was the one that beat the Kazakh, and I got a very good Asomba. And I knew how good he was in there, hence why I used him as my main sparring partner for my Maruti fight. I took that fight with Maruti in mind because there was similarities in my eyes. Obviously differences, Thomas Asomba's a southpaw, a bit slicker, but there was certain features that were quite similar. So I don't think the step up was gigantic. Asomba's bigger, probably stronger in certain aspects, but obviously Maruti is more of an elite, much more of an elite fighter, and has the career and the background to prove that. But I feel like if you really look at the fight, apart from probably seeing me more switched on and more energetic, there's not too much differences in how I made them fight. So I don't think I made the fight a massive step up, even if it probably was more. But that pays more testament to the way I box and how I approach it. If I stood there in the middle of the ring with either of them, I probably would have lost both of them.
So what's the dream fight for you? Martinez?
Martinez. Right now. Because obviously, you can never look too far ahead because boxing is way too unpredictable. You don't know what weights people are going to be. You don't know what's going to happen. I can go and lose my next one. You know what I mean? So you can never look too far ahead or try to plan and prepare for too far ahead. However, the one thing I do know is beating Martinez would sort of cement my legacy as yeah, Sonny was a good fighter at any stage. Do you know what I mean?
Is it slightly personal as well, given what happened with him and Charlie?
Not really, because that fight against Charlie probably paints him in a much like more as a dangerous opponent. But then possibly he is. Do you know what I mean? I'm not saying he's not, because he is a great fighter. He's very good, very powerful, wild, strong. But I know that Charlie Edwards that got in the ring. I was there for his camp. I was there for his weight cut. I was there for waking up with him the next morning. And do you know what I mean? He wasn't the best. He weren't the Charlie that jumped in with Rosales. He had too much to lose the night before. And not because he'd cut corners, not because he'd sort of, you know, weren't taking this fight seriously. He's sort of a consummate professional. His diet's spot on. His training's spot on. But he just got that little bit too big to make flyweight anymore. He had 3.8 kilos. I remember it. He said something different the other day, but I know it was 3.8 kilos that he had to lose from about 7 o'clock the night before the weigh-in. And he was already at like 4% body fat at that point. Do you know what I mean?
You've obviously got, I want to say, an unusual style, unconventional style. Who did you look up to growing up, boxing-wise?
There's probably been quite a lot of influences, to be fair. But the biggest is probably that I just don't really like getting hit. When I was young, I'm 9, 10. Every time I get caught clean, I'd still be fighting. I never jumped out of the ring. But I'd have tears streaming down my face. I used to just get so, like, angry. And I couldn't really control them, but I'd still be boxing, do you know what I mean? And then I think eventually, obviously, that faded away. I got used to getting punched, you know what I mean?
But, yeah, because for someone who doesn't like getting punched, you do a lot of sparring.
Yeah, love sparring. If I could just spar and do pads and not do anything else, I really, really would. But I understand that you can't just do those two things and be successful. But I don't know, I guess people like, I think one of my biggest, that once I've saw Willie Pep box, and once I heard that he won a round about throwing a punch, I said, yeah, that's my guy. You know what I mean? Rigondo as well. Always love Rigondo because when I was an amateur, my heroes were the best amateurs. I never really watched professional boxing. I don't think I really understood it at the time. You got to remember, when me and my brother started, we was like first generation boxers, if that makes sense, from our family. Our dad wasn't a boxer. His dad weren't a boxer, etc., etc. So a lot of my heroes were the lads in the gym. Believe it or not, Bradley Skeet was someone I looked up to a lot when my time at Oldfield. He was like the top boy, one of the top boys.
He's up here now in Sheffield, isn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, he's down the Ingle gym. Yeah, he's down the Ingle gym. I've seen him actually. I've seen him not too long ago. He's come down this barn a couple of times. But it's like fighters like him. Andrew Selby was another one. Massive. I would say influence on someone that I watched and was like, that's who I want to box like, someone like that. Which was crazy because that was before my brother ended up moving up to 52 kilo and then ended up boxing him, do you know what I mean? And losing, I think it was like 17-14 in a very close fight over in Finland or Poland or wherever it was. But yeah, I think at amateurs there was a few like different people that I just picked up off and liked their style. But I think really, Willie Pep, Rogondo, Mayweather as well for a great part. I know we're kind of different. He does that. He's one step out, same as me, but he likes to stop to time their reactions. I like to not stop moving to get them into my rhythm. Do you know what I mean? But yeah, them sort of fighters, them hitting and not being hit. Once you've mastered that, I think as I get more confident and mature, then you'll probably see me letting my hands go a little bit more. Do you know, once I've been there, done it, seen it, or been in with everyone. Because already I think I probably have a different era of confidence of, okay, I've done that against Marutti now. So, well, do you know what I mean? You do get a lot of confidence from something like that.
So was your dad into boxing at all?
I don't think particularly. He probably liked the odd fight here and then, but it was one of his good friends, a man called Jimmy Beckett, who I believe was my brother's godfather, I believe. But it was an old boy he was, and he used to have the Clockhouse boxing gym down in, I want to say somewhere like Coulsdon or somewhere like that. I can't fully remember because it was obviously way gone before my time. But my brother was putting on a bit of weight, and then he ran me when we was, he used to own a flower stall like shop in Mitcham, right by the train station, Jimmy Beckett. And we used to go there all the time, a couple of times a week or once a week, just for my dad and go see him. And Charlie Rand came out of one, so I want to start boxing. He was like, really? Because he had all the old pictures of you know, boxing. He had like a caravan next to his flower thing. And it was like his office, you know what I mean? It was like something out of Snatch, you know what I mean? And he had all the pictures of the boxing up on the wall behind him in his caravan. And yeah, Charlie wanted to do it, so he got us taken down to Roundshaw Boxing Club, which was just a little club where, you know, like when you get there, you have to quickly set everything up in like a leisure centre sort of thing. Fighters like Tony Owen was down there at the time.
So did you go together or did Charlie go first? And you
went? He went first because I was too young.
Yep.
So I was 8 at that time and I had about 3 months, 3, 4, 5 maybe months where I was too young. So I'd go and pick him up with my dad all the time, but I weren't allowed to train.
What did your dad do for work?
He owned a tyre shop for a large period of time. It was a second-hand tyre shop, but anything with cars, my dad could do. He was like, his background, he was a stock car racer, believe it or not.
Okay.
And he used to travel around the world. That was his like passion, that was his thing, racing. I mean, when we was first growing up, I think, I remember being five, six, maybe a little bit older, not much. My dad had us in go-karts, me and Charlie, every weekend, every Sunday, he'd take us. And we'd go on the track down the bottom of our road. So I think that's, he was half edging towards that. And then I think he realised he'd been through that sport. Not being a millionaire, that's a millionaire sport. He only got by having the know-how. He was like the mechanics for the teams and that, do you know what I mean? So
you know Howard Eastman was a good go-kart back then?
Really?
In the day.
No, I didn't know that. But Howard Eastman, I watched him box at York Hall. Was it Williams he boxed in York Hall?
Richard Williams, yeah.
I was there for that. That was my first ever professional fight that I went to.
Okay.
Howard Eastman, yeah, York Hall. My first ever.
He could fight. Ever. Well, they both could, both those guys. Were you and Charlie close as kids then? 3-year age difference.
Yeah, we was always sort of age mates, to be fair. I mean, we had a lot of the same friends. And we went to different schools and at secondary went to different schools and whatnot. But yeah, it was always quite close, I think. We have an older sister, but she was living her life. She was obviously moved out. There was times when she was living in the house, but for most part of the, especially the first 11 years of my life, it was just, you know, mum, dad, whilst they were together, and then when they weren't, but then me and my brother, do you know what I mean?
You're quite mischievous now. Were you mischievous then?
Yeah, I've always been cheeky. I've always been cheeky. I've always had a lot to say. Always thought that I was at least one of the smartest in the room that I walked in, you know what I mean? It got me in trouble more than not, and I think life makes you realise that what you think, you know, is nothing compared to what's out there.
Were you a bad kid or just grubby?
I always had a lot to say. I used to get in trouble a bit at my secondary school. I went to a very good secondary school. I went to a grammar school. It was all boys until sixth form. And when I first started there, year seven, I was probably like one of the... Even though we spoke a lot, I had so much enthusiasm for learning and work. Obviously, I'd started boxing just about a year or before this or a couple of years before this. And obviously, I was taking it serious to the extent of... for other kids at our age, but obviously not to the extent that we did start taking it. And because I was in like an 11 plus school where you've got to pass an exam, everyone else is really smart. I started as one of the top 10 in the year because they did, like, at the end of each year they had exams where people was graded pretty much where you was in that year, your averages. And it just slipped pretty much, slipped a bit, to be fair. Still come out of all my GCSEs and A-levels and that, but as I was taking boxing more seriously, and as the work was probably getting a little bit harder, I was probably then start, you know, being a little bit, not a class clown, I wouldn't say that, but you know, just having something to say when work gets hard, that's when you start looking for the distractions, when you don't really know what you're doing and whatnot. But I remember one year at school, I was in the whole school, I was the most punished kid in the whole school, one year. But it was never for anything really, really bad, it was just missing homeworks and being cheeky, having too much to say, you know what I mean? It was more stuff like that.
Did you lip off any teachers?
There was probably, you know what's funny, yeah? There was, so one teacher is my history teacher, and he still to this day, supports my boxing. I speak to him, between every fight I speak to him, he comes to my fights. Mr. Davies, his name was. And, we had, when he teached me at school, the first month, he'd only just joined the school, the first month, he kind of let everyone sit where they wanted to sit, right? So my table at the back was me and all my mates, you know what I mean? So we were just talking. And after about 2-3 weeks, it was like, everyone else in the class stayed where they was. And then he put two of them over on that table. And I put my hand up and I was like, why am I sitting? And he went, you're sat there. So for 2 years, I was on a table on my own at the back of the room just so I couldn't talk to people. And to be fair, I did have a run-in with him with house football as well. I think I told him to go fuck himself, you know. I think that was probably one of the worst of things I ever really did. But it was over house football. There were six houses. And that was mad competitive in us. Whatever sport it was, you wanted to win that, especially if you had a decent side. And I remember he had a mayor and referee one time, and I think three of our players got sent off. You know, in a half an hour game, I remember I told him to fuck off. I was the third. But, like I said, I got inclusion for that, and that was probably the worst I ever really got, to be honest. I weren't particularly that bad. I was just more cheeky, so I sort of knew the boundaries I could push.
With your boxing, did you box similar to how you box now? Were you always sort of switching and moving?
Yeah, probably a lot worse. Over 3 rounds. Because I was so used to always sparring. 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 rounds some nights when I was at Newham, I used to do that. When I was at Repton, I used to do that. When I was at a boxing club where there was enough people to do that, I always did. It's what I enjoyed. And because I was always one of the topper kids, it was good for the other lads always to spar. Do you know what I mean? You learn off each other. Sure. And really, there's no better boxing training to prepare you than sparring. But pacing myself to always be able to do 8, 10, 12 rounds probably was a bit detrimental when I got to the top level of the 3-round fights. Do you know what I mean? You know, I had a good amateur career, but I probably would have achieved a lot more if I was more focused on the 3 rounds. However, I probably wouldn't have had the instant success that I've had as a pro.
Sure.
Because I've come in and every single fight I've had, I've done it within myself. Do you know what I mean? I've not lost yet. I've not been stopped. I've not gassed out in the last 2 rounds and been spent and been holding on and been falling. Do you know what I mean? I've done it, I've taken it all within myself. And to say that I've only been a pro coming up to 5 years, not 5 years yet, 16 fights in, I feel like I've sort of showed a lot of maturity to this stage already.
So tell me about your amateur career, because there were highs and lows, weren't there?
Definitely, because my brother was always 3 years ahead. He was always sort of like the benchmark, and he had a lot of success early on. I'm talking at 14, he was European schoolboy champion, and he was on GB at 15. Whereas me, I was full of talent, but I never worked as hard as he worked. I was always messing about. I would do the sparring, I'd do the pads, and then I'm sort of trying to just do what I can to not do too much. You know? I mean, I was just one of them to start with. And my first eight fights, I won them all on the club shows. And then my first national championship, I lost in the final. And that was like my whole world coming to an end, to be honest. I cried, my dad bollocked me, do you know what I mean? I had boxed terrible. And it was against a kid that I ended up boxing five times. In five national finals, every time a national final, Scott Rankin, his name was. He beat me the first year. We was talking about that Newham the other day, because that was my final at Newham. So when Maruti was boxed and lost against Nanito Donet, I think that year I lost in the schoolboy finals. Do you know what I mean? So, and then the next year I lost in the finals again to the same kid. That broke my heart, that did. All that, like, it's like a whole year later just to be in the same spot. It was horrible. And I think the only reason I was really losing them fights is because I was always small for the weight, and this kid was a giant. I'm talking, it was like, it's like we shouldn't have been in the ring together. It was like that much of a height difference. Obviously the same weight. It was only little, I'm talking like 30 kilos. But I was only like 26, fighting at 30. And then I was like 30, fighting at 34.
And then I had... Smaller than your dog now.
Yeah, I know. And then I had one more year in the schools where I lost in the quarters. Didn't lose that fight though. And then I quit boxing for about 6-7 months. And I did what sort of any normal 14-year-old was doing. You know, I was chasing girls. I was not worrying about boxing, weren't taking it serious. You know what I mean?
So was this the bit where you previously said to me you were doing things you shouldn't do?
Yeah, but it was never too bad, I'm talking. Because I started living with my mum. My dad was like a strict sergeant major. My mum sort of showered me in love and affection. And she knew I wasn't a stupid kid. So there was not once that old Bill knocked on the door. There weren't once that she was really getting called up and it was affecting her day. Because I was always sort of knowing what I was doing. But I mean, I'm talking, like, I had school. I used to have to get up at some, like, 6:30, be gone by 7:00. And it took me like 45 minutes, 2 buses to get to school when I was living with my mum. But I'd be like out at my girlfriend's or whatever, or my friend's until like 2:00 in the morning on a school night. Do you know what I mean? Like that was normal. Do you know what I mean? And then just being like little shits, to be honest. Do you know what I mean? Just loitering and, you know, throwing snowballs with a stone in them at cars. You know, just being like a little dickhead. Do you know what I mean? More than anything. But I think it was more because when I lived with my dad, and I thank him for it now, obviously from ages 11 to 14, 15, you don't enjoy being, oh, well, I can't, everyone's going to meet up at the park. I've got to ask my dad. And even then, it's not a guaranteed yes. And even then, if he says yes, he's usually dropping me and picking me up. Do you know what I mean? My dad was on it. He understands how dangerous the world is. When as a kid, you're not thinking about any of those things. So he was always sort of on us. Like, don't get me wrong, he let us do what he wanted to do, but it always had to be accounted for. Yeah, do you know what I mean? Does that make sense? So yeah. he weren't the type that I could say, oh, I'm just going to go stay on my mate's house and then end up on a park until 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. Do you know what I mean? No chance. He was speaking to the parents before, do you know what I mean? Or ringing or messaging them, do you know what I mean? He was like, but one thing I never had was a lack of effort from my parents, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sounds like the stuff I do for my son now. Yeah. He's 14.
Yeah, and you are, and now me as a dad, I appreciate so much more than I ever did before. I mean, I take my son once a week to football now and I enjoy it, love it. My dad used to take us 6 days a week boxing or training or running, do you know what I mean? Up and down, like, constantly, like, burning himself to empty just to make us. No wonder why we are two world champions, do you know what I mean? Like, no wonder.
You mentioned Charlie being successful super young. Was following in his footsteps, did that make things easier in the sense of open doors, or did it make things harder in terms of the pressure on you?
My dad was probably the biggest form of pressure in the sense of he had very high expectations, but I have very high expectations for myself. So even when he weren't there, like I remember the last time I lost when I fought Kieran McDonald. Oh, I cried like a baby in the changing room after. Like, but I set such a high expectation for myself, do you know what I mean? If I lost against Maruti, I would have been heartbroken because I put so much into boxing. Do you know what I mean? I feel like I'm a good loser. I don't always kick the toys out of the pram. I show my respect, do you know what I mean? I understand the sport, but I hate losing. I'm so competitive.
So when was the last time you cried then? Because you've said to me before that you've got quite a hard exterior and stuff, but so far I think you've cried about 3 or 4 times in terms of telling me about different times. And
yeah, when I was young, I was a crier. That's why I think it changed. But then...
So when was the last time you cried?
I'll tell you. It was more recent, when my baby was born.
Okay.
When my baby was born, so...
Happy tears?
No. Relieved. So yeah, kind of, but I was relieved more than anything. So first child chance, pregnancy was a breeze. It really was. The whole thing, all the way through, really.
Easy for you to say that.
I know, but she'll say the same. But what I'm saying is the delivery, everything was just easy. Bobby, it was different. She had diabetes in her pregnancy. There was a ready to induce her. And when I arrived at 5 o'clock in the morning to the hospital, it was time for the baby to come. She started bleeding. They pressed the panic button. 6 doctors and midwives running around, trying to calm her down, getting her to sign consent forms whilst on gas and air for the C-section. And it was scary, the heart rate going up and down, them getting me to hold they had me holding the monitor on her thing. I didn't know what I was doing, how hard I meant to pull it on it. Do you know what I mean? I'm just there sort of panicking, trying to be as cool and calm as possible for the mother's sake, because at the end of the day, if she starts going in pure distress, then the baby's going to suffer. But you could see the heart rate spiking and then dropping, and it was horrible. It was scary for about 20 minutes, convinced in my head I was the baby was going, do you know what I mean? 100%. And then they rushed her off to theatre. Everything was so quick, and then they sat me in a little box room. No one come to me, no one said nothing to me for about 30 minutes. I was sat, just tears coming out of my eyes. Like, I was texting Grant. I was meant to be sparring Thomas Asamoah 3 hours' time. I cancelled that before he had a chance to leave to make sure. I went, look, I don't know what's going on right now. Cancel the spar and rearrange it for the back end of the week. Because this is only 4 weeks out of my world title fight. 4 weeks. It was the 5th of April. I boxed on the 30th. So dead centre of camp, do you know what I mean? It was on the back end. And then someone ran down the corridor and went, be quick, you might miss him. I'm thinking of taking the piss, so I'm walking down. And I was like, no. And then someone was calling me, and as I ran in the room, Bobby just started crying. He was just out. And then it was then that proper, you know what I mean, seeing that. Yeah, but that is crazy, because I didn't cry no tears when chance came, because it was just smooth. You know what I mean? Our baby's here. I don't really, I'm not a big cry. I'm not, typically I'm not. But yeah, that had me shed a tear.
When we've talked before, you said you relied on natural talent. What's natural talent to you? Because it's something that you appear to have, but I don't know how I'd describe it.
For me, natural talent is when someone picks up something quite quick and sort of runs with it. And I feel like with boxing, I always did that. But I never sort of applied myself to sort of make best of that talent. Not until I started getting older. And I think as soon as I did start applying myself, you see the rewards, you see the response of my career. But I think talent's a hard one, do you know what I mean? Because no talent gets anywhere without working hard, learning. When I say talent, I just say someone that picks up things quite quick and without sort of too much stress on the brain. Learning new things for some people is very, very hard.
Sure.
I mean, for me, once I've sort of cracked it, I can pick it up quite quick. But to be fair, some of the things that I was doing outside of the ring and then somehow still managing to perform at level, a lot of people would be surprised, you know what I mean, to a certain degree.
You won the ABAs, but you didn't have aspirations for the Olympics or anything like that.
I really did, to be fair. But I've got a massive chip on my shoulder that my face never fit anywhere. I won.
Are you talking about Team GB?
Team GB in England. Don't worry, I got on Team GB. And then, so where it really started was obviously I'd lost a few. The first 3 years I lost, right? So I weren't the best in England, so I weren't boxing for England. Then won my first national title. I ended up winning 6 in a row. So I dominated every competition I went in for about 3 years, 4 years. I never got sent to a Europeans, never got sent to a world. Do you know what I mean? There was never that much sort of interest in me ever. Every time they had two fighters to pick for something, I was always not picked. Always.
Why? And you think it was because your face didn't fit? You don't think it was to do? Could it have been just to do with your style?
That's what I mean. Yeah. Yeah. When I say my face don't fit, I mean my style. They always looked at it and thought that will not work.
Do you think that was what they thought, or do you think that they were sort of grooming you for a couple of years down the line?
No, because I'm just about this bit right now. I'm talking about England. So this is before, because England and GB are the two different people.
Sure.
Like they're like two different boxing gyms, really. They don't have all too much the same, even though they sometimes use the gyms and whatnot. But so in England, I was constantly getting not picked, not selected, not invited to trials. To the point of when I was about 18, 17, I was getting invited to now box England. Say England versus Ireland. I'll tell them to go fight themselves. But just because of how, like, you're not sending me to the Europeans when I'm the oldest out of the two, and then sending the kid below me. Do you know what I mean? The stuff like that. And then they sent a couple of people that then either later that year or the next year I then beat. Do you know what I mean? So I always had sort of that BMW on it, that even though I'm doing everything, you got to remember, my brother won something, sent to the Europeans, won gold. Won something, sent to the world. So I'm sort of expected that. I expect, okay, if I win the same, then I'm going. And it never worked out like that for me. Even when I got on GB, my gripe with GB was more, don't get me wrong, it was better. Because obviously once you're on there, you're one of their fighters. But I was on there for about 4 months, 5 months before I got sent to my first tournament. The whole time I was fit, the whole time I was ready. Galau, who I'd beat in the ABAs, which I ended up winning. And that's what got me onto GB. His semi-final, getting to the semi-final and fighting me, got him on GB also. We come on at the same time. He had been and performed at 5 different tournaments before I got my first one at the same weight. And obviously, he's a friend of mine. Someone I really rate, someone I really respect, someone I really like. But at that time, he was a rival, was a competitor. And he was getting everything. Even he took over Harvey Horn pretty much straight away, who wasn't doing really bad, you know what I mean? Which normally you don't see. They normally number one gets protected, they go the number two. But Galaud sort of went, and rightfully so. Look at him, he's done absolute wonders in the amateurs. He's a really good fighter, that he is. But obviously from my perspective, well, hold on, I've beat him. So why are you not sending me to Germany? Why are you not sending me to the WSB? Why are you not sending? That was like the bee in my bonnet for a while. Then I finally got my first tournament, which was in the March. I'd got in there in the December or the October time. It was about 6 months actually. And March was my first one in Finland. I was the first draw, the first fight of the whole tournament. And this was my first fight for GB. And I drew 2-time Olympian who'd already qualified for Rio. That was the next year or coming up later that year. I think it was actually already qualified. Former world champion 3 years before. He was the world champion of won the worlds. And I beat him. Kazakhstan, Berzhan Zakhapov. But in 30 seconds to go in the last round, I threw a right hand, a top 10 glove, pinged back, and I snapped the ligament on the back of my thumb. They told me that no punching for like 8 weeks, minimum. That put me out of the qualifier. When I come back, they sent me straight to a specialist. To be fair, they looked after me in that respect, had all physio, but they said, look, you're not competing. And then there was a qualifier in 4 weeks' time from that. I believe personally, that win was sent me to the qualifiers because no one on my weight had got a win like that. That kind of put me boom straight away. And especially if I went through the whole tournament, I had an Estonian next that my brother had stopped. He was a bit useless, to be fair, this Estonian. Had him in the semis, and then I would have had a Russian in the final, which would have been like a hard fight, but that didn't happen. My thumb went. They pulled me out the next day because obviously my thumb was literally like out here, black. It was bad. Went Harley Street straight from the airport on the way home. Seeing got a full ligament snap. They told me all the scientific words, but it's the sort of the backstrap, if that makes sense. So when it does the push, that weren't working. But they said like 8-12 weeks minimum. I boxed in the ABA final 6 weeks later. Because this one I lost, but once they sent Galau 3 weeks later to the qualifiers, one qualified. I wasn't going to sit around and do nothing. So I entered the ABAs with one hand.
Your mum fell ill as well, didn't she, when you were an amateur?
Yeah, so...
What happened and what was her diagnosis?
So, that was the same year that I went to uni. So it was when I was 18, so I'd just moved up to Sheffield. And at that time, my mum was still my kind of support network. She organised my...
Life,
yeah. I was having this conversation with Lyndon yesterday. Like, do you know one of them... Oh, mum will find it. Oh, mum will do that. Do you know what I mean? It was literally that with my mum. She babied me massively. And then I'd been up to Sheffield for about 3 or 4 months. At this stage, I mean, she was still putting, I think, £20 a week on a Sainsbury's card, you know, from down in London that I could. And, like, she never went to Sainsbury's. She worked in Asda. But because the Sainsbury's were close to me, she used to go to Asda to top it up, you know, Sainsbury's to top it up, like, proper babied me. And then we found out she had cancer, which was always a sore topic because her mum died of it. And her mum died of breast cancer when she was 50. And around a similar age, my mum got breast cancer. So it was just a bit, you know, when your mum's died of it, it's just even, it hits that little bit more, do you know what I mean? And what happened with my mum basically is around the February time, she started treatment. I was 19. And I think she started treatment on like a Wednesday or a Thursday. Had 1 or 2 days, I think it was 2 days or 2 days of it, of radiotherapy. And then by the Monday when she was meant to have her next one, the Tuesday, I think it was, she got rushed into hospital, basically got slipping into a coma. So what had happened is they wanted to start treating her within a time frame. She was in a queue or she was in something. She should have got an MRI scan. The MRI scan never happened because they wanted to start the treatment. And they didn't find, because they didn't look, a brain tumour. And the treatment caused a leak on the brain, pressure, fluid. And a few operations later, a few major brain surgeries. Do you know what I mean? She's brain damaged in the state she is now. I mean, she got cancer freed a few years ago, I believe. But yeah, so really it was cancer, but it was the treatment that sort of made her to how she is today.
What was the diagnosis thing? And you mentioned the coma. Was she close to not surviving?
Yeah, it was like, there was a couple of real touch and go surgeries. It's sad really though, because if you gave my mum the choice, how long ago was it now? What, 7 years ago? If you gave her the choice then, whether she'd be alive now in the state she is now or dead, she would have chose to die 100%. But I know my mum. I know she was a very proud woman. Do you know what I mean? She was the carer. She was the caregiver. I mean, my mum, the house was probably dusted of 3 times a day. Do you know what I mean? It was, everything was always spotless. Everything had a place. She was always well presented. Everyone that ever met her, and she was always, you know what I mean? Very, very proud woman. I always used to call her Vain Me. I said, you're so vain, you mum. But, I mean, for us, you know, having my two sons to be able to meet her, you know what I mean? So there's good and bad.
Taking the belt.
Yeah, of course. But my mum loves babies. She loves kids. Like, her best days of her life was having us, she says. Giving birth, best days of her life.
How hard is it for you now with what's happened to your mum?
The only time I ever shed a tear of it was when I first went down. So you got to remember, on the Sunday, I was in London. My mum cooked a roast dinner for me, cleaned up. I was at Sheffield at the time at uni. Bought a suitcase down of washing and was going back up with a suitcase full of clean washing. Do you know what I mean? It really was like that.
Yeah.
My mum dropped me to the train station on Sunday. By Tuesday, she was rushed in hospital. Like, literally 48 hours later, I remember I'd come back from training. I was still sitting at the time, the old gym though. Just got back about 8 o'clock at night, sat down on my bed. My sister rings me, you need to get down in her. Like, what? It's mum. What do you mean it's mum? Mum's gonna die. Yeah, crazy. That's the phone call I got. And I went, what? Looked at the train ticket. My mum and dad never spoke they don't speak. When they broke up when I was 11, didn't speak for this whole period of time. Not like one word uttered to each other. My dad was there at the train station, at midnight when I pulled in to St Pancras, drove me straight to the hospital, St George's, and waited outside for hours and hours and hours. Do you know what I mean? That was the last time I cried about my mum, to be honest, when I first seen her there. And she was in a bad way, and obviously a couple of days before she wasn't. And then since then, it's just been... There's never been really too much good news, because it just is what it is at this point. A brain is not like a bone. It don't repair.
You mentioned, obviously, that you've been down there and you've been up here in Sheffield, which is where we are now. You're trained by Grant, who's one of the go-to trainers in the sport at the moment. Although I say go-to trainers, he's got quite a high set of standards. He won't just see anyone, I'm assuming. You and Grant have faced your critics together, haven't you?
Yeah.
Because people wrote you both off individually and as a duo.
Yeah, of course, many a time. And that probably just spurs us on more. Boxing, you've got to understand, we're in a world where you're only as good as your last performance and you're very quick to get written off. I mean, you only have to look at someone like Marie. 13 years unbeaten, 2 times world champion, something like 11 world title fights. That's the only one he'd ever lost or something like that. And or the second one to Nonito Donaire, and that was on a cut, really. And then you got people now who've not really seen him before calling him useless, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, but he didn't really do anything apart from walk forward. It's like, that's boxing, and that's the beauty of it. There's some people that everyone looks for different eyes, so we never really care about people writing us off.
Why did you select Grant?
So, I'd been away. So the times I did box for England versus Ireland, it's England camps, I'd been away with Dalton a couple of times. So for me, the best kid that I'd seen in my eyes coming out of Sheffield, that I'd sat there and watched box, was Dalton. Like I said before, my heroes, the people I looked at were the people in front of me. I'm quite ADHD kid. So whatever I'm in, I'm fully invested in. Do you know what I mean? So when I'm a pro now, I watch all pro shows. I go to all the pro shows. Before, it was all the amateurs. We used to go to all the amateur shows when anyone in our club was boxing. But for me and my brother was not. Even my dad would drive us up to Newcastle just to go and watch him and be a part of it.
From down south?
Yeah. And they would take all the other fighters and that. At one point, you were driving minibuses for boxing clubs. Yeah. And my dad did a lot, to be fair. My dad did a hell of a lot.
Are you close now to your dad?
Unfortunately, no. But I think I'm just a difficult person. I think it's me normally that's the issue. I mean, I have sort of principles and I don't really bend. So once someone doesn't sort of fit into how I'm, I have to take myself away. So I know I'm more time the issue. You know, a lot of families, they just do that whole, oh, we're family. But I think...
You're too stubborn.
Yeah, stubborn. And I like enjoying my day, every day. I like enjoying my journey. I like coming to the gym, enjoying what I do. And anytime there's things that sort of affect that too much, I kind of try and cut it away. I mean,
That's cold.
Yeah, definitely. But my dad's very Sergeant Major. So I told you I left.
You don't conform to that.
Yeah. Well, I did and I didn't, because I would always be the... My dad would even say that. Growing up through boxing gyms, my dad would tell me from talking about 12, 13, 14... that there isn't a boxing coach that can tell me about boxing. He gave me a mind, like, the way he saw it, he thought Charlie always needed the coach to be on him. I just needed to be independent and let do what I want to do. Do you know what I mean? That was sort of the mentality that he sort of implanted on me. Because obviously, when you're that old, if you're constantly getting taught that you know more about boxing than these coaches, you're not always going to listen to them too much. When I moved to Grant, that was the first time my dad wasn't really involved in my boxing. And yeah, he probably didn't like that too much. Do you know what I mean?
So what does Grant do that other coaches don't do? Is there stuff that has... You mentioned Dalton, who's now one of the fastest rising pros in the country. You're world champion. What are you guys doing here that's making it successful?
Do you know what? He doesn't really fanny people. He don't ask lick. Do you know what I mean? He tells you his truth. If you're asking him his opinion, he'll tell you his truth. Whether it's right, wrong, it's his truth. Do you know what I mean? And that's what I like. We can have a proper, honest, open conversation. There's been times he's not been happy with me. There's been times I've not been happy with him, but we're grown-ups. We'll sit down, we'll talk about it, we'll discuss things. And he knows boxing. And not only that, he studies boxing. And he puts his heart, mind and soul into it, which a lot of boxing coaches don't do. I'll be real, a lot. It's kind of, it probably sounds a bit weird to say, but he's got his kids. But you've got to remember, his kids are sort of involved in his boxing. There's probably nothing more important to him than boxing. And he sees people that he trains and looks after as his children and his family as well, and treats us as such. I mean, the weekend after I had won the title, I spent all Sunday at his dad's house. Do you know what I mean? My two kids. Do you know what I mean? It's like they're family to me. They really are. Like his Dalton and Chelsea, the one that was in here before, his daughter, they're Bobby's godparents. Do you know what I mean? It's really close knit family affair, and he's just very good at his job, and because he does put 100% into it, when he's not just telling you on a Saturday, all right, then go up Rough Valley and go do a 6 mile run. He's there walking his dogs whilst we're running around. He's not saying, oh yeah, you lot meet up and go do the hill run. He's there picking people up at 7 o'clock in the morning. Like when I used to go to track, 6:30 in the morning we used to start at one point. 6:30, 7, he'd be picking me up on the way through. I mean, he's invested so much into him and into me, obviously, as well as Dalton, obviously. But for me, speaking personally, he shows me the effort and energy that has only ever really been matched by my dad, just because no one else has been as on and in it with me. Sure. Because it was always my dad sort of was the reason why I was leaving all the boxing clubs. I mean, for 2 years, he was everyone's best friend, and then you'd get pissed off, alienate someone, and then upset someone, and then they'd be like, oh, the kid, obviously the boys are, we want them to stay, but you're going to have to take a bat, and obviously that just weren't going to happen, do you know what I mean? So it's just one of them. But with that, we've got a lot of experience going around, a lot of clubs working with a lot of good coaches, so there's pros and cons, but when it matters, I've been with Grant now, 7 years? Coming up to 8 years.
Did you turn pro because you were disenfranchised with the amateurs?
Definitely. Obviously, you've got to remember that last few months. I didn't even have my eyes on the pro too much because I was still thinking Olympics and all whatnot. But then what happened was I beat that Kazakh, injured, missed a qualifier, Galau qualified, so that's it. The Olympic dream for this cycle, over. Then I entered the ABAs against the will of GB because bear in mind, they don't like the number ones. They don't like their boys really going on there anyway. Do you know what I mean? And I was injured. I shouldn't have been fighting, really. No excuse though, but I fought 6 weeks later when I was told by the physios not to, but I said, no way, I'll win that with one hand, do you know what I mean? How wrong was I? Got to the final though. And when I got out of the ring there, I kind of decided, nah. Because what happened, every time I lost, usually, was when people just stood off me and nothing really happened in the fight, and then I was coming on the wrong side of it. So I was getting so frustrated at 3-round fights. You can't really sink your teeth into a 3-round fight. I was getting that. And my rhythm, like I said before, was always matched for 10, 12 rounds. That's what I was always doing. I was always doing them long rounds. I think... And you've got to remember, I had my brother, who was now, I think, a year and a half into a pro career. And you know, once you start... When I was on GB, once you start seeing the money that he's making and how he's getting built up and the shows that he was on, and I was fighting in leisure centres, dimly lit in Finland, freezing cold, snow outside, no one there, beating one of the best fighters at my weight, no one asked, you know what I mean? Then my brother would go and knock out a journeyman that's only won 2 fights, and then all of a sudden, it's hard to be involved there and stay amateurs, especially when, for me, I was doing everything right and still weren't ever getting my just desserts. So then I come out of that, I went back to the change room after I lost in the ABA finals, my second year in them, after I won the year before, and then I said to Grant, I'm done with amateurs, I'm turning pro. I'd already had a good relationship with MTK.
Yeah, because you turned pro in Marbella.
Yeah, that was my debut, and I was training over there, so I left, not I left Grant, because at the time he couldn't train me. There was a time when amateur and pro coaches, they couldn't do the same. So... I didn't even have the conversation because he had such a good squad at the time. I mean, there's a picture up there from the amateur days. 1 year we had 4 entrants into national championships. All 4 of us won. Me, Dalton, Junaid and Chris Latecky, through senior, youth, down to schools, you know what I mean? We all won. And that was like Grant's little squad at the time. So there was never a chance for me going to try and approach him and say, look, Grant, forget Dalton and the rest of the boys, come train me. But the moment that he could, even though I was over in Marbella, we spoke 2-3 times a week, always. I had some problems over there. You know, me and Danny Vaughan, let's just say we didn't gel the best.
You and who?
Danny Vaughan, who was training me at the time. But I got a lot of time for Danny. He's a good lad. We had some good trips in our short time. You know, when Charlie went to Germany and that. I like him, man. He's a good bloke. A good trainer as well, but just wasn't for me. So yeah, as soon as Grant found out that he could do both again, he didn't even tell me. He went and got his license before. And then he just said, he waited for me to sort of approach him, going, oh, do you know what I mean? And he went, well, I do, because he wouldn't have come and crossed the line, because now I'm training with someone else. He wouldn't have just been like, hi, Sonny, come back, you can now if you want. Like, he's got more respect than that. But once he was aware of the issues that I was facing, he went, well, I weren't going to tell you, I weren't going to say anything until you sort of made a play and move for it. Sure. But he went, I've got my pro license and it's all good to go. And then I came straight back.
And having spent so much time up in Sheffield, it was a bit of a no-brainer, I guess.
Yeah, but I mean, you got to remember, I had such a good career with Grant. No setbacks, really. Okay, I did lose in that final. I didn't think I lost, to be fair. GB didn't think I lost. It was one of them 2-1 where I won 2 rounds on the cards, but they were both split rounds where he won the first round by all 3. So, you know, when it adds up, if you look at it, it's like, hold on, I won 2 rounds there. Do you know what I mean? But it's just the way it added up that I'd lost. But yeah, I didn't really take that as a defeat, but it kind of just put the nail into the coffin to my amateur career. I just thought, nah, well, and how lucky am I that I did turn pro and make that decision? Because 5 years later, I'm a world champion. Where if I was waiting for the dream of the Olympics, I'd still be waiting for it.
What did you think you'd achieve when you turned over? Did you think you'd be a world champ?
I always thought I was good enough, because I've never really got in the ring with anyone and felt out of my depth ever in my whole life. And I spar up to lightweights, like super featherweights, like good ones as well, do you know what I mean? I've never felt out of my depth like, oh my God, I can't be in it. Never had that feeling. So I always thought, oh God, I'll get there eventually. And I always thought I'd be a world champion. And then when Charlie went and done it, that sort of cemented it, because I'll be perfectly honest, I genuinely believe I'm the best flyweight in the world and have for a while. And I feel like I mix up all the super flyweights too. So obviously when Charlie won a flyweight world title, I'm thinking, oh, I spar you and you're a world champion. Do you know what I mean? I'd definitely get one of those 100%. Because, you know what I mean, we've been sparring for so many years. And I just thought, yeah, well, I'm at least at that level.
You know what I mean? Were you happy with the progress you made after turning pro? First few fights, first half dozen fights?
Yeah. I didn't have the same sort of hoo-ha that he had. Because obviously I've always got to compare.
Yeah, the Olympic springboard's different. Yeah, yeah. Different everything, isn't it? The build-up, yeah. The money, the whole lot.
Of course. But I didn't mind. I didn't mind that my debut was in Spain. And there weren't that many, but it was a mad show. It was actually quite well sold, to be fair. There was quite a lot of people there, but it was there was kickboxing fights going on. It was crazy. Do you know what I mean? It was like the fight before me was kickboxing or something, and then it was me boxing, and then someone after me was kickboxing. Then there was Big Sexy Sean Towner. It was a bit mad in that aspect, but I didn't mind that my debut was there. And then 3.5 weeks later, I boxed or something like that in Scotland in a dinner show. I didn't mind. As long as I was learning, as long as I was fighting, as long as I was earning.
Did you feel that you were paying your dues?
Yeah. I felt like I didn't mind. Because I always understood that the pressures that come with first fight, boom, debut, live on TV, 8 o'clock. There's a lot of pressure that comes with that. I didn't have that.
Would you have benefited? Did you have the chance to go to a match room and getting buddied up and going on Charlie's bills and all the rest of it?
With that side of things, there was definitely interest there, because I signed for MTK and this was my greenness of just sort of kind of at the very beginning wanting to be on the big shows, expecting a certain sort of treatment. I spoke to Eddie privately, obviously I knew him because of Charlie, and I kind of stepped over MTK's toes a little bit, and then I sort of learned that from earlier. Like, if you're going to have a management, let them do their job, do you know what I mean? So I think they spoke privately, obviously. I didn't end up going with Eddie. Obviously, he's a great promoter, but they said, look, trust us, and we'll get you there, and haven't they? Do you know what I mean?
Do you think that, is that, are you pleased with the way things have worked out, or do you think you would have liked some of those early fights on big bills with Charlie, because they would have surely paired you up on the same shows and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, but I couldn't change all too much about my career, if looking at it. I mean, there's not too much to complain about with. I don't mind that my first experience of a big show was fighting 45 minutes after Gervonta Davies beat Liam Walsh. Do you know what I mean? I, like, gone 12 o'clock at night. Like, literally gone. Like I thought I wasn't going to fight. I didn't mind that I was wrapped up since 6 o'clock, told her, you're walking at 7, you're going on just before the TV starts, and then BT changing. Now we want Sonny as the float. But then there was two floats. Do you know what I mean? Like, I didn't mind all that adversity, and because you learn, it's experience.
It's tough at the time, though. It sucks.
But you see, with me, I take everything in my stride. I never dwell on things too much. You know, when you've got a short goal that you're heading towards, like you're in a train that's arriving at that destination, you getting in the ring and having a fight, there's no point stressing over all the little things that are happening. So I was there chilling at 6 o'clock. I was told, oh, you'll probably be on about 8 if one of the fights goes early. Then people running in, why are you not wrapped up? Then my first fight for the Frank Warren, and quickly thing, quick shadow box, I'm ready to go. Okay, no, you're benched. Didn't take my wraps off for 6 hours. 6 o'clock, and I got in at 12. Kit on, everything. Went and sat ringside to watch, do you want to fight Liam Walsh? Basically, like, just outside of it, with all my kit, wraps on and everything. Went back, there was one more fight, Sam McNess. Had my thing in, and I boxed well. Got a stoppage, but I didn't mind that I had 3 small halls, then, like, the graveyard shift, then back to small hall, then 5 o'clock on a Belfast show, all off TV. I didn't mind that. So when I got my Ryan Farag fight, and this fight, they say, look, you're headlining Box Nation. I took that, and I thought, yes, I've arrived now. And now this is my opportunity. Perhaps if I'd had 8 TV fights, that wouldn't have brought the best of me as much as it would have been. It might have been, if this goes wrong, I could be not on TV no more. Do you know what I mean? When it probably would have been, if they built me up and then I start losing, then you get dashed to the side. But because I'd got there, and earned my place there, then when I had my opportunity, I really earned my place. So that's when the phone started ringing from you know, my promoter and my TV broadcaster. No, we actually want Sonny to fight now, because we've seen he can fight, but I'd earned it. I didn't mind being hidden away. Like, I know a lot of people, for me personally, sort of probably rub up management and rub up trainers and probably rub up definitely promoters the wrong way by turning over and sort of expecting everything to be hand-delivered and marked. Here's a TV slot, here's a nice, easy opponent you're going to knock out, and here's a lot of money to do it. Like, wouldn't that be nice all the way through our career? But you don't learn nothing from any of that. You don't, I don't personally think. And if anything, it just sort of overinflates your ego. It is creating hype, but the moment you believe your hype is the moment you're going to come unraveling. So for me, the type of person that I am and how confident I am anyway, it was always, I'm going to get there. I'm going to get there. Because bear in mind, whilst I was still doing Brentwood Leisure Centre, MTK shows, my brother would then, boom, next fight, BO2. So, you know, a copper box or, do you know what I mean? So I was always just thinking, I'm going to get there. And then every step, I'm going to get there. And I'm
was
going
there
to
any resentment at all?
Nah, never. Never, ever, 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 ever. Different paths, different journeys. He probably deserved to be straight on the Sky Sports and straight on TV slots. He did a lot more as an amateur than I did. Especially going all around the world for like years, travelling and fighting all these different hard kids from... I didn't do that. I did it for a couple of months. As soon as I didn't get picked, I'm gone. Do you know what I mean? I'm not going to be a sparring partner.
You mentioned Ryan Farag. That was a personal fight, wasn't it? It was a grudge going into that.
Yeah. The year before, we'd sparred. And it was all cool. Sat in the sauna together, chilled. Was even on a night out, and he was there. He did try half mug me off, and that's when I knew there was like a bit of resentment there. Because I'd punched his head in the sparring 2 6-rounders. I did. He had people running around the port when I was on nights out. Because I was partying. I was out there partying, not even in training. He was in training, right? And I went there, and on the Friday and the Monday, I punched his head in for 6 rounds. But he was a lot heavier. He was a lot physically stronger. But he just couldn't really get near me, as you've seen when I fought him. It was pretty much similar, but a bit more holding from him, because when he did get me, he was grabbing onto me. But then I seen him on a night out, maybe around that time, and there was a girl that I was sort of seeing who worked out there at the time, was at the bar. I weren't drunk or anything, so I was just chilling. And then he's come over sort of half pissed, and tried mugging me off in front of her a bit, but I just played light of it, made a joke. Basically said something about about me running or about, you know, something along those lines. I can't fully remember, it was a few years ago now. So I knew I had the inkling that he weren't my biggest fan, even though he was being all right with me. Then a whole year later, I got offered the fight. And then I accepted, obviously. I was excited. Oh, defend my title, headline the show. 2 days later, or a day later from accepting the fight, the board put out Ryan Farag versus Jay Harris has been ordered for the British title. And I thought, oh, he's going to take that now. I mean, he's going to take the British over the European. But he didn't. I was on to my management. We had the same manager. And I went, he's definitely not going to take that. He's definitely going to fight Jay. But he didn't. Fair play to him. And then I remember messaging him when I found out that he's definitely taking a fight. And I could probably find the message. I think it might have been on Twitter. And it was something along the lines of, respect for taking the fight. Hope you have a good camp. See you fight week. Or something along those lines. And he went, yeah, squirrel face. Something, something else. And then started just like cussing me. Do you know what I mean? And the personal behind it, yeah, I don't think I've ever really fully said it, but he basically grabbed hold of one of my brother's ex-girlfriends in there. Like, they'd broken up for about 4 months, didn't see you speak to each other for 4 months. And he must have got hold of her. And all the way through the build-up of the camp, that's all he was saying to me. Ah, basically saying that he'd thought, I fucked your brother's girl and now I'm going to fuck you sort of thing. Do you know what I mean? Like, just the whole way through. And I was thinking, do you know what? I didn't even like this girl when she was on the scene. Do you know what I mean? So I went asked. But that's all he did. And then he was really, he really invested heavily in sort of trying to make it a back and forth on like social media, and which I'm there for. I've got the legs for. I've got the energy for. But it weren't something that I ever start, because I didn't forget my fight match with Ryan Farag and think I need to get in his head to beat him. I'll piss on him with my eyes closed. You know what I mean? I don't need that thinking. I don't need the little advantage. But he was really angry. I remember we was doing the rules meeting at the back of York Hall after the weigh-in. Me, Grant, his trainer Albert, who cornered my debut, bear in mind. So Ryan Farag's coach was in my corner for my debut, right, in Spain. Albert, legend, the Iceman. It was just us and the WBO bloke. And he was trying to give it to me over the table, like trying to give me stick whilst the guy trying to explain the rules. So the trainer was like, shut up, what are you doing? You know what I mean?
But you guys, are there bad feelings? That you squashed the bad feeling though, didn't you?
We did, after the fight. Yep. We spoke, was in a drug testing room. He gave me my prop, said you did a lot more than I expected you to. I thought you were just going to run. You stood there, you held it, you boxed really well, you won, you deserved it. All of that talk. Me saying, yeah, really tough, thanks for taking the fight. Being a humble champion, whatnot. Until about 6 months later, he's running around on interviews and on Twitter saying that, oh, I had a bad shoulder, Sonny owes me a rematch. Like, I literally wiped the floor of him. I lifted him upside down and wiped the canvas with him like it was a mop. Do you know what I mean? It was that easy. Genuinely easiest fight of my life. Probably because I switched on. Because I was invested into the fight. And I could not lose that fight. Do you know what I mean? So it brought the best out of me. But, like, he would not beat me in a month for Sundays. Like, no way.
You mentioned the type of boxers you've liked, Willie Pep, Rigondo, those guys. You're not bad at the old trash talk. Are there some of the trash talkers that you liked? Do you like that sort of thing?
It can be, but like,
a lot of people don't do interviews. They're worried about clickbait and stuff. You're not, are you?
No, not at all. One thing that's important for me is like my integrity of being myself. Pretty much any time I've seen a fight, really, the version that the fans see, the versions that the camera see, is never the same as the one that we see in the gym. And often a lot, it's like, you've got a lot more personality than you let on. Do you know what I mean? You've got a lot more about you than...
Too manicured.
Yeah, but then they want to be media things. people want to be role models. Like, I look at this from this perspective. Like, my brother has always wanted to be a role model. He wants people to look up to. Which I understand, like, you're as a person in the position that he's in, yeah, you do have a lot of, like, young generation looking up. So I understand trying to paint that image of being a role model. But me, I've never really been too interested in that, because for me, my opinion is I get punched in the face for a living. I'm not really an ideal role model for anyone. Go listen to doctors and scientists and politicians and people that know probably more about the world than I do. I'm a boxer. Enjoy my boxing and my build-up to fights and that, but I'm not trying to paint myself to be this perfect role model, to be something I'm not. So because I've stayed quite consistent to myself, when someone's saying something to me, I've not invested loads of energy and time and effort into being this person. Because then when you do that and then all of a sudden people are not liking you, or people slagging you or commenting on you, then your sort of facade will start falling away and then it will affect you more. Because I'm being myself. If someone wants to say something about me, not off, I'm being myself. Do you know what I mean? That's not going to change. You know what I mean? I live my day, I wake up, I go to bed, same as everyone else does. And just because of people's opinions on me, I'm not going to massively start altering my personality or...
Have people really crossed the line with you on social media? In fact, I can say that because you've crossed the line going back at them, haven't you?
Definitely, but I'm a reactive person. Like, if someone walked up to me in the street and slapped me around the face, they get a slap back, do you know what I mean? I'm not a bully, I don't think a spiteful person. I don't sort of sit there and try and target people and make people feel bad about themselves. I just sit there and exist, but if people want to sort of have a go at me, because of how I am and how people know I am, I feel like anyone now that really goes out the way to give it to me, they're kind of wanting the other side of things, because you know you're going to get it, do you know what I mean? You know you're going to get it.
Do you ever read any of that criticism and take it personally? Are there days when it does phase you?
No, and the reason why I couldn't do that is because one thing about me, because obviously I'm from the generation of, you know what I mean, we were the first generation to come through with computers as kids, you know what I mean? So I remember having an 8, 9, first computer in the house, you know what I mean? Like crazy. But because I'm from that computer generation, we're the most, you know, accustomed to
it.
Really.
To it, yeah.
Yeah, so I've been through, you know, when people used to slag each other from BBM and you know, like actual personal things. And I've been through actual, like, harder stuff on it. Now, all these people don't know who I am. They don't know what I do in my day to day. They know what I show them. So if they want to have a go and pick apart my life, they don't know me. I'm happy with me. I'm happy with myself. I feel like I'm doing right by my kids. I'm doing right by my friends. I'm doing right in boxing. So
that role model thing that you said, you don't want to be a role model necessarily. Does that change now you're a dad? Do you think like your kids might look back at some of the stuff or go through your Twitter or anything and think,
at the same time, the way I reason with myself is everyone deserved it. I give it to. Because you can't start crossing like for me, you respect someone or you don't. You don't teeter on the line of disrespect and then when someone steps right over it, get angry. You don't draw the lines. If you start the disrespect, you can't start then setting out goalposts and the rules.
So when you go back and forth with people, do you feel yourself getting angry or you cut off?
No, that's the problem. I'm sitting there creasing, laughing. When people are saying stuff at me, like, I have people saying stuff like, my mum's a Chernobyl victim and loads of different things. That's just one I can draw on. Everything personal about me, you know, my height, my teeth, my looks, my boxing, pigtails. Anything they can get, they will get. But you've got to remember, I live this. I know this about myself. I know I've got funny teeth. I've had that since I was my whole life. I was offered braces when I was 15. I had to have my jaw broke 2 places, have one of them head, you know, round the head things.
Yeah.
Because of how overbite I am.
They like globes or something.
You know, yeah, do you know how? All I know is, was it Ralph out of Ed and Eddie? Or maybe not. One of the characters in there had the metal thing that went round their mouth. Anyway, him. I'd had to have that. And they told me I wouldn't be able to box for 18 months minimum. 12 months, 18 months minimum. And that, 15 years old. My teeth getting sort of bantered in school and being a talk, like being the focus point, wasn't enough for me to miss a season in boxing. So you now think someone can say it to me all these years later and it's going to bother me too much. Like, I'm happy with myself. People can say anything they want about me. I don't mind doing the cussing because I see it as like sort of, you know, like debating. You know, people go to debates, they debate about things that they didn't know they was going to speak about, but it's just the sport of debating and getting one up. I kind of see it more like that. But in the sense of we're bantering. So I'm not really taking it seriously. And most of the people that are giving it to me, they're not really taking it seriously. They want a reaction. They want something to break up that day. They want to feel something. And I'm just quite good at sort of investigating quick. So say if I see someone on Twitter, I don't usually respond too much to the people that I know is a fake account. But if it's someone who's coming at me with that energy and you've got a picture of you and your missus on there, you've got your government name, right, let me search Facebook. Let me go deeper. So I start investigating it. And I just terrorize people. But I never go for anyone first. Never go for anyone first. Maybe I need to be a little bit more, you know, careful with some of the things I say, but I've never had any real big scandals. I've never had to like issue out apologies to make sure that I stay doing what I'm doing. You know what I mean? It's all pretty much tongue-in-cheek and good fun. And when you sort of go back and see what they were saying first, it's pretty much like, oh, you kind of deserve that a little bit. Do you know what I mean? So that's the way it is.
How long are you going to be fighting for?
A long time, hopefully. Touch wood. As long as my body and my mind.
Another 10 years?
Another 15, if possible. I'd like to go to a 40. I want a record that looks like one of them old school records. Like 50 wins, 6 losses, 3 draws. You know what I mean? All good fights, proper fights. My plan was always to get to the highest level and just keep boxing there. And now I've been a world champion. Oh, I am a world champion right now, but no matter what happens, I'll always have been a world champion. If you can just keep the momentum going, even if you have a dip, if you can get back on it, I'll always be fighting at this level for a long time. And that's what I want to do, sort of cement myself.
Historically, flyweights and super flyweights don't make a ton of money.
Mm.
Do you know what you want to achieve financially? And is it possible to achieve what you want to do financially in boxing? And if not, and if you don't make the money that you need to make, what happens after boxing?
To be fair, though,
is the idea to get rich through boxing and retire?
To be fair, though, it's all relative. Obviously, we'll always get out earned by like the top heavyweights, the top 0.1% that's earning millions, obviously. But it's your platform and your profile. If you can keep building it up, you're still getting paid. Like me and Charlie, we both get paid well. Like, and if I keep winning now, I'll be elevating to a next level where you won't be saying, oh, that's not good money, do you know what I mean? Because really, I've been a pro since I was 21. Never had a job, never worked. I'm providing for 2 kids, run households, supporting people that are dependent on me. And I'm living quite comfy at the moment. So if as long as I keep the direction I'm going, like now is at the stage where I'm looking at houses, and if I keep winning and succeeding, then it'll be like just expanding. I'm in a really good place, to be fair.
You and Charlie are at odds at the moment.
You could say that.
But you don't think it's going to be a long term?
I don't know. I'm stubborn. We said that before. But just family.
You're the common denominator here.
I know. That's what I always say. And like, I know I'm... Like, I'm never, I don't think, the initial problem. But once a principle's crossed that sort of doesn't align with how I see my life and you know what I mean? And it's just one of them. To be fair, he's probably always got more bias than anyone else, being my brother, being close to him that. But at the moment, there's miles between us. So.
You said he congratulated you for the world title.
Mm.
That mean a lot?
Not really, if I'm honest. But there's probably very few people congratulating me. That did mean a lot. Do you know what I mean? I told everyone what I was going to do.
What do you need to do to improve?
Punch a bit harder. Apply myself like I did for that camp, for all my camps. Be very switched on. Not take my foot off the gas now, because this is where it gets hard.
Do you think you can punch harder? Is that a thing that you think, you know, people talk about nature, nurture, and punches are born and that kind of stuff? But also, if you're doing drills specifically, and obviously, particularly where you're so young, look at someone like Canelo, for instance, who wasn't obviously a destructive force 10, 12 years ago. But then I was working this out the other day. Obviously, he said he's in the gym twice a day, every day. And obviously, so say he does that 300 times a year, so that's 600 sessions, that's 65 days off, which is probably too many anyway. So obviously, over the course of 10 years, that's 6,000 sessions. And obviously, if you're working on strength, speed, and power, you'd like to think that after 6,000 sessions, you will be getting stronger, fitter, faster.
Yeah, and I feel like for a lot, like the evidence in the gym suggests that my punching is getting there. The thing that I need to do when it's time to start sitting down my feet, but like that Maruti fight, the way I was to win was to outbox him, was to move him. That was the game plan. It weren't get 6 rounds up, and then when he starts tiring, put on him. That would be the game plan for someone else. It weren't hold your feet, make him work, and get him tired early. The game plan was box and move him. No one hurts him. Like, no one, like, he can take a shot. He's solid. He's fit. Outbox him, outscore him. That was the game plan. I stuck to it. I think as I get older, as I mature, as I start believing in my power a little bit. No, I know I can hit relatively hard, but you got to take into consideration that when I'm boxing the way I box, my feet aren't planted enough really to be sort of trying to lay people out. I'm not taking that split second because I'm getting away. That's why I'm not getting hit like I'm getting hit, because I'm punching the way I'm punching and I'm firing in from all angles. I'm sort of slipping a jab and then firing a left hook through the middle. Shots that no one else really gets away with. Yeah, I'm not, maybe not stunning them or putting them down or hurting them all the time, but look at when I fought Pedro Matos. When, okay, Grant was like, yeah, go on, let your hands go now after the first few rounds and let me get into it. But I listen to my coach. If he's not telling me, try and punch holes in him, I'm not. Do you know what I mean? So, and Pedro Matos, look, I'm a flyweight world champion now. I stopped him. And then, obviously, I know we're at different stages of our career, but, like, a big punch, and Dennis went the distance with him, do you know what I mean? So, Dennis is a big puncher. I'm seen as a feather puncher, do you know what I mean? I don't punch at all. But when I do, when the plan is to stand there, and I can get my space to work, I punch harder than people give me credit for, definitely. Anyone that spars me will pay testament to that, anyone. But when I'm fighting, my goal is to win alone. That's got me to where I am today. Even if I hurt someone, I don't think, oh, let me jump on them. Stay relaxed, stay composed, and think about the 12th round, because that's how I win 9 times out of 10.
And you like to be active. You told me that before. You always want to have a date to shoot for. Any date in mind?
We've been speaking. Frank Warren posted out yesterday that I've got my next opponent, who's Jason Mama from the Philippines. 16-0, I believe. I think 8 or 9 knockouts. Good fighter. I'm looking at, you know, July, August.
Because you're in the gym now. You're doing S&C and a bit.
So I'm sort of ready. I had one full week out of the gym, and I did a couple of sessions tick over the week after. And then
some foul blisters for anyone who hasn't seen it on social media.
To be fair, that started getting a bit more painful, you know, as it's getting hard and going soft, But it's all right. I'm good. I can't complain.
Got a couple of questions from subscribers. Yep. Derek Walmsley says, which boxers do you admire the footwork of? And is there anything you do footwork-wise which you've not seen any other people do?
In the sense of in the ring, I feel like I do quite a few things that a lot of people don't do. I stand square, inviting them on. I sort of react with their movements and throw shots from all different angles. I'll switch from orthodox to southpaw, with my head down and throw like a hook. I think I do a lot unorthodox in my feet. But yeah, a few people I look up to with their footwork. Billy Joe Saunders always being one of them. You know, his footwork is tremendous. It really is. Frankie Gavin always had good footwork. Andrew Selby as well. Woody Pep, sort of, just the what I... Once I realised you can just sort of float around the ring and have them constantly walking onto you. Once I realised you could do that, that's what I started.
Well, there was that great line I heard from you in the Steve Bunce of Mike Costello podcast where you said you can go missing in a 22-foot ring and no one can find you.
Yeah, and I feel like I can. And I feel like I really can, because there will be times that I'll spar and someone's a bit bigger than I would like and it's sparring, so I think, right, you're just not going to hit me now. And I'll just pick you with jabs, single shots, in and out. I can make it like that, and I can really make 12-round fights boring. Look at like what I did with Moretti. I made it a single-shot fight, picking single shots, boom, boom, in and out, had him fighting and playing to my... I had a 20-year at world-level vet fighting the exact fight that I wanted. And in a way that he never really got too close to winning. Like, there wasn't, like, moments of madness that I had to come through. Like, he tagged me, but everything was always under control. I was always calm, I was always composed. And, yeah, people might say, oh, well, he's old now, or he's past it. But he still very much was the most avoided man in the division. Like, no one else wanted to fight him.
Nick Taylor says, what's your best asset? Is it your ring IQ or mental toughness?
My mental toughness, and I partner that with my adrenaline. I always say if I could bottle up my adrenaline and sell it, it would be insane.
What's like, that, nervous energy?
I think once I'm in there, there's no quitting me. There is zero amount. I don't think about it. I don't think, oh, let me just jump out now. I don't think, oh, this is getting too hard. I just think about what I've got to do to get through. That's it. And I've tested it so many times now. Like, when I got put down against Granados in the second round, I snapped two ligaments in my high ankle. I forget the scientific name. Snapped two ligaments into the foot for the next 8 weeks after. I could barely walk, couldn't run, I couldn't train. I was in a boot, crutches. But for 8.5 rounds against a big punching Mexican, I danced around like there was nothing wrong with my foot. Asamba the same, when I rolled that ankle and sort of nearly buckled in half, I still moved around for the next 4 rounds like it didn't hurt. Marcel Braithwaite, before my fight, both my hands were smashed. By the second round, they were in bits. You see me, every clean shot I'm landing, my hands drop after. And I was barely throwing anything when he was there, just because he didn't want to hurt my hands. And then when I got put down and my adrenaline went through the roof because the threat's there now, I didn't really think about my hands too much after that. I've had loads of injuries. I've pushed myself through so many things. And if I'm honest, I'm not going to go into it, but my fight with Maruti, there was something that was the whole way through camp, the whole way, and this is no word of a lie, that affected every single training session I've pretty much done.
Physically?
Physically. I'm talking most, not most, a few exercises I couldn't do in the target area, couldn't do. A few fundamental parts of training I could not do because of this injury. And most people would have pulled out, I can guarantee it. I did it and I'm world champion.
Nice way to end it, man. Yeah. Thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
It was great to sit down with Sonny, met his American Bulldog, Kilo, and we talked obviously there about life in and out of the ring, some really interesting stuff. And I like Sonny's temperament to sit down. Hey, listen, I'm not a Sonny guy on social media. You know, he's clearly seemingly bulletproof on social media, which is more than I can say for myself. And he's happy to go on the front foot if provoked and all the rest of it. That's not me. That's not the way that I act or interact. But I get what he does, and I kind of see how it's working for him as well. So, onwards and upwards for Sonny. This interview also reminded me one thing, and that's that it won't be long before I interview a boxer who is more than half my age. But Sonny was great, and I mentioned there at the top that I'd interviewed him for BT Sport a couple of years ago, and I always remember that chat. I think Sonny was about 11-0, 12-0 at the time, and I thought he would actually be good for Boxing Life Stories because he is a good talker and he is a considered talker. What you see in terms of the social media backlash and all the rest of it isn't necessarily what you get when you sit down with him one-on-one. A reminder that Boxing Life Stories are on Facebook and we're on Instagram. If you can, please rate and review this podcast. Pop onto iTunes and give us a 5-star rating. It would always be massively appreciated, and a review if you can. And also the last couple, so Sonny Edwards and Glyn Rhodes, are on YouTube, and the next few will be too. So please check us out there. Search Boxing Life Stories on YouTube and subscribe to the channel too, if you can. We're also brought to you by Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do they find you the best people, but Hanson Lee help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. We're also brought to you by Delco Safety Compliance, who are a leading provider of professional fire, asbestos and safety services to businesses nationwide. They offer one expert point of contact for all of your fire, health and safety compliance needs. And you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. A huge thanks to Sonny Edwards. If you haven't listened to Glyn Rhodes last week, please go back and track it. The next few weeks, we've got Ryan Rhodes, we've got Josh Warrington, we've got Dennis Hobson all coming up. And they'll all be on my Patreon soon. So visit patreon.com/Tris Dixon. And I'll be back next week.